Hey everyone, Hoff here. Before we get started, we just want to send out a big thank you to our partner, Grind Coffee Co., for their support of the show. They're a convenient subscription service offering specialty grade, single source, 100% Arabica coffee available in whole bean and drip grind. Check out grindcoffeeco.com. Thanks again to Grind Coffee Co. for supporting the show.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Tace, and you're listening to the Builder Session Podcast.
Welcome to the Builder Sessions, a podcast where we chat with your favorite builders.
We get to know them, their stories, and hopefully inspire you to get off the couch and build something cool. I'm Hoff.
And I'm Rosie. And on this episode, Kevin Tates returns. We chat about his new endeavors into collision and refinishing education, how big picture thinking has its place as long as it's broken down into manageable tasks, and how integrity is what we do when nobody's looking.
All this and more on this episode of the Builder Sessions.
Kevin, welcome back to the Builder Sessions.
Lance and Corey, nice to, actually, I can see you guys, so it's nice to see you again, and it's great to be in your space. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm excited.
It's a long time. I looked back on Spotify this morning, just going through a guest we've had, and you were number two on June 1st, 2022. So this is, I think we're at 49 or 50. So this is cool to touch back and
50th anniversary.
That's funny. You know. Well, congratulations on growing the cast and being successful with it. You know, it's a crawl, walk, run strategy. You guys are now getting your sea legs and you're getting some traction. So I'm proud of you. That's great, man.
Thank you. It means a lot. And thank you for giving us a chance.
Yeah.
Right. Like you,
back in those days of the email. Hey, we're just starting this podcast. Do you want to come on? You bet.
You're like, hell yeah, let's go. And we were like, pardon? This guy we've been watching. Well, you go back, we'll link to the first episode in the show notes. But we were starstruck, we still are, but also really excited to call you a friend as far as friends that have never met in person, but
and see what you've got going on lately, because there's some big things in the world of Kevin Tates.
So what's all things Kevin? Let's hear about it. What have you been up to? And let's just have a good chat here.
Well, I've been up to a lot of interesting things, trying to figure out where I'm going with Paintucation. If you know me, you know that Paintucation is what got me my start in television. This year, 2024, it marks 20 years of me doing television, and the last several producing it on my own. And it's such an interesting thing. It doesn't make me feel old to look back and go, man, it's been 20 years. It's been such a great learning curve. So I'm humbled that I can actually make a living doing this still. And, you know, the whole television landscape has changed so much. And it's been a really interesting thing for me to transition from, you know, cable TV, being just a hired gun talent to doing turnkey instructional and installation videos for a whole bunch of different manufacturers. It's been a great run as far as that goes. I'm going to hang something out there. I'm going to feed it to the universe and hopefully it comes back. But I've been talking with the network and with the production company about another automotive TV show. Very excited about it. All the pieces are in place, from the production team to the studio location to the network that it's going to be on. I can't drop names right now, not yet, but we're waiting for a few more yeses and, you know, on a sponsorship level. And then we're gonna hit the ground running, and it's super exciting for me because I don't know. I think back to when I started on the DIY network and how green I was and how scared I was to walk onto a TV set with a production crew and all that kind of stuff. But you know what? You knuckle up and you muscle up and you get it done.
Yeah.
And now the ammunition that I've got, the experience, the camera time, all that type of stuff, and I did a podcast last night with a group of entrepreneurs, and I said this out loud. I said it because I'm excited about moving into it. If we get a show, that's great. I'm ready. I'm excited, and I look forward to the process of it instead of being afraid of it. And it's not because I'm not really good at what I do because I'm better than anybody else. I'm not any different than anybody else. I've just got the acquired skill. And let's face it, as technicians in the trades, you don't step onto a job site knowing everything about that job. It doesn't matter what trade it is, whether it's, you know, woodworking, electrician, fab skills in a body shop, in a custom shop. You got to start somewhere. So I feel confident that moving forward, that that it's going to be a great experience. It's going to be a great program. And I'm excited about it, not because I think I'm all of that, but because I've put in the time and I've put in the work to be ready for it. So it's exciting for me. If it happens, great. And if it doesn't, well, I'll continue forth with my other 75 agendas that I've got going on.
Oh, no kidding. That's really cool. I've heard, so that's very humble, I feel, of you, as far as, because I've, usually the thought of humility or the definition of humility that we assign to that word is, you know, thinking down of yourself. Oh, no, if someone says, you know, you're really great at what you do, you're so good at this, and, you know, oh, no, I'm not. No. That's not humility. I've heard it said that humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's about thinking of yourself less. And so it's not like thinking, you know, like, demeaning yourself in that way, but accepting who you are. And I think that's a big, and we don't need to get it. It's just a thought that I had. It's a big hindrance for a lot of, I don't know, tradespeople in general, where it's like someone compliment and you're used to going through this whole, you start the job and you don't know anything. You're green as hell. And you know that you don't know anything. And then all of a sudden, you're at this spot where people are like, holy crap, you are doing a really good job. You're so skilled, blah, 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 to the naked eye, right? And then you're left with this, like, you know, you're battling back and forth between, like, maybe it's like an apprentice brain and a journeyman brain or something like that, and being able to accept that. So just when you said that, like, I have these acquired skills, and not denying that. It's really cool. I just wanted to say that. I could have said that in four words, or I could have said that in an hour, which I just took. So.
No, it's all good. And what comes to mind when you say that, and I'll take that as a compliment. I want to be gracious about it, but there's nothing wrong with owning your power. And I also think that people confuse insecurity with humility. Insecurity is second guessing yourself. It's being afraid or of overextending yourself. It's putting yourself in an awkward and uncomfortable situation when you know you shouldn't be there. That's insecurity to me. And it's a crippling mindset. And I think humility, but also recognizing where you, like I said, where you can own your power. I think that's where we can move forward, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's a universal thing. That's a grown-up thing. And you know, we weren't always there. we have to start somewhere. And whether it's growing your skill set or growing your mindset, it's an accumulative process. So I'm not to get all woo-woo and all that kind of stuff.
Let's go. Bring it on.
No, but it's the truth. It's how we grow up, how we grow into who and what we think we are, which is ego. And, you know, ego is not a bad thing. It's a learned thing. And if we can back up the ego, and by ego, I don't mean arrogance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, confidence. And if we can back up the talk, then we can really move forward, and then we can help. And ultimately, everything comes down to being able to offer a life of service. That's really what it comes down to. Whether you're religious based or church based or school based or military, Peace Corps, it doesn't matter. It comes back to service. And that's one of the things that I've learned, is that if we can be of service to somebody some way, then we're fulfilling our purpose, right? And that is huge. That's pie in the sky. That's, you know, it's metaphysical. It's all those things, all those three and four syllable words. But when it really comes down to it, why do we even go to work? It's because we want to be of service to our family, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. So why would we want to be teachers? And this is a question to you guys, because you want to serve your community.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
So I want summers off. I want summer. I'm just kidding.
Oh, wait, why not? So you can do what? So you can go to car shows and you can be an enthusiast in the community.
Well, let's be honest. Teachers don't usually get summers off. They're planning the whole summer anyways. But
yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's the thing that people don't understand. But yeah. So I don't know. It's fun stuff, man. It's fun to think about it and think deep every once in a while at the same time as we're building hot rods and smoking the tires off the backside of them.
I love it. This is... We have found our people.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And I found out that in Claire's home, there is a drift competition on an old Air Force base.
There is.
I did not know this. My nephew Kevin he brought his kids with him and went to go and see my stepdad. And they went to this drift competition. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? How cool is that?
There's a big drift community in Claire's home. I just found this out last summer.
So speaking of drift, I got to tell you about a project that I built. I don't know. Was I building the Miata when I talked to you guys last?
I think you were just about to like reveal it or like as soon as did you just start it?
Just starting.
Yeah.
It. Yeah.
So embarrassingly long time to finish a TV project. And there's been a lot of stalls along the way. So in the world of me, we had some catastrophic parts failures. We lost a hard drive full of most of the episodes.
No.
Yeah. It was hours and hours of irreplaceable footage, and it really made me sad. So we're going about it a different way. We timed out of events this year. We were going to go to an autocross and in the industry term in television is to pay it off, to pay the car off, which is do a road test. How does it feel? How does it run? What does it do what we intended for it to do? So if you don't know what I'm talking about, I've got a 93 Miata. For you Miata guys, this is an NA. It's a first design. And it is a supercharged LS V8 with a T56 and a Ford Thunderbird rear axle. It's a Corvette in a Miata skin.
I love it.
Too much power in not enough car. And it's one of the funnest cars I've ever built. We have got 440 wheel horsepower in a car that weighs 2,700 pounds. And I can't do the metric math, but you can imagine. So literally that drivetrain is about a Z06 Corvette in a car that weighs half as much. It is fun. We've only got about 7 pounds of boost, but it's got the man pedal and 6 forward gears. And gosh, it's just a great little car. I worked with a company called V8 Roadsters that does all the chassis stiffening stuff. They've got a big brake kit. We use a 97 Ford Thunderbird 8.8 differential, which is an iron differential, put Ford Cobra guts in it, big beefed up axles, billet hubs, all the things are in this car. And I have to tell you, it's the funnest car that I've ever built. And I've built a ton of them on TV and for my personal stuff over the years. And I'm just crazy about this thing. Right now, I've got to replace the throwout bearing, so I can't drive it, but we're still waiting on that. So it's going to be probably one of the first autocrosses, February, March, in around our area here in Tennessee. We start to see outdoor events coming around again. So it's going to be that long before we have any kind of a TV debut. It'll be on my YouTube channel if anybody wants to watch, but it's going to be fun. I'm very excited about that. And it was a huge learning curve, right?
Yeah, no kidding, especially... Because there's so many purists and there's so like stuffing an LS in that thing. You're probably going to hear a little bit from these guys and these. It's, but you know what? Build what you want. That's the whole
build
thing.
Build what you want. I don't care. Yeah. If you got hate for this car, bring it on. Come and drive it. It's an amazing little car. The Mazda Miata is the world's most popular two-seat roadster. And it was literally a dream of a guy that wasn't even a car designer. He was an automotive journalist. And he bait and switched and tricked Mazda into making this car. The short version of this story is this guy was a journalist. And he went to, he had a consultation with the design head of Mazda in Japan. And he said, you know, you guys need to make this throwback to the English two-seat roadsters, rear drive, front engine. America is dying for this. And they went, no. And so he said, okay. So him, the editors of Road and Track, Car and Driver, everybody started to create a buzz. They went in their op-ed columns, their forward columns, you know, you open up the front pages and you hear from the editor. They created a buzz amongst the magazines for a two-seat roadster in the United States. And
my.
And it started a viral thing. And all of a sudden, the readers are coming back in. Yes, we want to do this. So it created this buzz even before social media. Mm-hmm. The next meeting this guy had with the heads at Mazda, they said, you know what? We think there might possibly be a need for this car. And it was built based off of that. You know,
wow.
Based off, it was a grassroots enthusiast outreach.
Big picture.
But it was created by guys that knew what to do. And they were brought in on the design team. Who, you know,
get out of here.
Story, wow. Right?
Wow. So, that's incredible.
So how many hours did you have into that Miata build?
Hours.
For somebody who doesn't know the time and long, like what goes into chassis and all this stuff, just a ballpark hours.
Okay. I'm guessing here, and I would have to go back and look at it. I'm guessing probably 600 or 700 hours on this car. That's a very conservative build for a custom build. And I say that carefully because it's not a full custom. Mm. It's a stock body. We've got a wide body kit, which is basically, I cut the fenders and quarters out, welded them back in, and then put fiberglass scoops on it. I worked with another couple of companies that do performance accessories for Miata, for mostly spec Miatas, which is a huge thing in the race community. And they were just fiberglass bolt-on flares. And I sanded them and painted them. I used a budget paint system from Summit Racing. And it still looks really good, but it's single-stage paint. And my philosophy is there's more paint in the can. If I get some cone scars on this thing, if I get rock chips on the sides of it, I don't care. Let's drive the heck out of it, and let's do what it's made to do, which is be incredibly fun, high-performance vehicle. BF Goodrich, we're using the Rival S tires. They're a 200 treadwear tire on a 15-by-10-inch rim, which is why we needed the wide-body kit. And, you know, it's got a lot of traction. So linear acceleration in this car, because there's lots of power in such a lightweight and sticky tires. When you get it to hook, it just takes off and goes. It's like a turbocharged car. But it's a LS1 out of a 2004 GTO and a 2010 ZR. It's a ZR1 Camaro it's an LSA supercharger on top of it. So it's got a blower sticking out of the hood. Jeez. With the lid sticking out of the hood. It's a really aggressive look to it. And it's just ridiculous. We've got about 7 pounds of boost, which is all I need. We could easily go up more in boost, and then we risk blowing the tires off. But right now it's so well balanced, and I keep babbling on about this car, but it's such a fun car and such a fun way to show that you don't have to put $1 million into a vehicle to have a fun pro touring car. It's going to be an autocross beast, and it's affordable and accessible, which is another reason that I chose the Miata. They're great cars. They're very well balanced, very well designed and engineered. And now we just throw a crap ton of power at it, and it makes it even better.
Love it.
Wow. I want your day to day. You know, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in your shop and the builds, and because you've done some really cool stuff. And for somebody to take a build through all the stages and then go have fun, I think there's a lot of people that maybe not build these custom cars, but they buy them and they sit, and to each their own. But it's nice to see people building cars, using them, and also doing the budget friendly style, because not everybody has, you know, a crap ton of money to throw at a toy that's not daily driver.
Right. Well, I'm so lucky, and if you want to call it blessed, that's fine too. But I'm so fortunate to be able to do what I do for a living, which is also my hobby, which I'm able to trade exposure for parts opportunities sometimes. I don't say free parts. There's no such thing as free parts, because we have to represent those companies properly. Yep. And we have to do what we say we're going to do. So sometimes we get sponsored parts that help me have the resource to build the vehicle that I want to. When I was on a network doing television, those sponsored parts are built into really expensive contracts. So that's how that happens. So the parts are just part of the whole process of making automotive television. On a more limited basis, when we're doing maybe some streaming stuff, then, you know, sometimes there's partial payment involved. Sometimes there's different ways of exposing, dropping names, social media video, and it's an accumulated exposure that's as powerful, if not more visible, than some automotive linear television. So it's a changing landscape. But back to the point to where sometimes I get some sponsored parts, and that makes it easier for me to do. But really and truly, it's a trade-off for time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's easier to write the check and just buy the axles. And then you can just put them in. You don't have to spend the time producing video and producing, you know, a tech article for a magazine. And that's very time consuming, those processes are. And I like doing them. I like the expression of that. I like staying out in the industry. So I still write tech articles with the few magazines that are still left. So so again, that's it's a trade-off of time. Mm-hmm. We talked about hours into how long it takes to do vehicles. So I have to segue into this. There's a new car show in Middle Tennessee. It's called the Triple Crown of Hot Rodding. It was this enormous car show in Gatlinburg, and it was ongoing for about 10 years. It was called Shades of the Past. Huge show in the Southeast. Thousands of cars would show up into Gatlinburg and in the Knoxville area. It was this wonderful thing. And basically what happened is that Dollywood, the big theme park up there, expanded, and then Shades of the Past, which basically ate the whole town for a weekend in the summer, wasn't allowed the permits anymore. So they had to find a new location. They found it at the Super Speedway in Nashville. It's just outside of Nashville. It's actually in Lebanon. So now they've changed the name of the car show to a different name, and now it's called the Triple Crown of Hot Rodding. Their awards were called the Triple Crown Awards at Shades of the Past, and now it's called the Triple Crown of Hot Rodding. So I attended the first one. I'm working with a company called AMD, stands for Auto Metal Direct. They're an aftermarket manufacturer bringing sheet metal and other parts into the industry. They're very forward on education and training, and also they do a lot of social media outreach. So we've partnered for 2024. I'm a spokesperson and brand ambassador for AMD, and it's very exciting because we get to do a whole bunch of really neat stuff, and we can get into that later if you want. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about this thing at Triple Crown. There was so the guys that were there were Dave Kindig, Chip Foose, Steve Mank, Jesse Greening, guys from like four or five other different TV shows. Everybody's there. So about a week before, I was talking with my buddy Steve Mank, who was a co-host on the Muscle Car Show back in the Power Block days.
Yeah.
Steve has been instrumental and behind the scenes in so many builds. You guys have no idea the length and breadth of his career. He was part of the movie car design team that made the first RoboCop costumes and vehicles.
Get out.
One of the Batmobiles. He was instrumental in doing that one. I think the one with Michael Keaton. But anyway, so he was a great co-host on the Muscle Car Show for I think with Tommy Boschers. But Mank and I have stayed friends, and we're just talking. And I said, let's put it together a roundtable, because AMD said, hey, KT, what are we going to do? Let's do some seminars. Great. Let's do some video. Let's look at all the cool cars. Great. Which the caliber of car was unbelievable. Everybody was there. Everybody in the industry was there because it was the inaugural one. Everybody wanted to say, but the caliber of car was better than I've ever seen in any indoor show ever.
Interesting.
And it's an outdoor event at the Super Speedway in Nashville. So it's a go-to event. If you're listening to this, find a way to go to the Triple Crown. You will not be disappointed. I know people that are backing out of SEMA and Battle of the Builders to go to Triple Crown next year.
No way.
I
mean,
it's going to be that important for sure. JF Lanier from Asuyas, I think he's probably going to go. We talked about that. But anyway, so we drummed up this little roundtable to talk about the industry, to talk about how people go about creating million-dollar custom cars, and whatever, that's a misnomer, but shops on that caliber that are displaying and winning awards at a show like Triple Crown or the Grand National Roadster Show or the World of Wheels shows, it's a whole other philosophy and a whole other build strategy with those shows. So on this roundtable, I was moderating and hosting. We had Chip Foose, Jesse Greening, Dave Kindig, and Steve Mank, and we had this panel discussion on things about the industry, training, philosophy, where they got their start, how aftermarket parts fit into a high-end custom build. What do you do with the E-code? Do you know, are aftermarket parts any good? Are they better than original? Are original better than aftermarket? It was really, really a great discussion. And it lasted just about an hour. And these guys just gave of their time. So it was a really fascinating thing. So circle back to, and please feel free to edit this stuff out.
No, I'm going too long. No, just keep
circle
talking.
Back to the amount of hours that it takes to do a build on the caliber that these guys execute for their customers. There was a car behind us that a good friend of mine built. We built a couple of different cars together. His name is T.C. Panic. He owns Bay One Customs just north of Nashville in Springfield, Tennessee. So this car is a 2017 Hellcat Challenger with a 1969 Dodge Charger body swap. So it's not just a hacked up thing with a big set back down on it. When you open the doors of this car, the Hellcat illumination on the ground works.
That's sweet.
The parking sensors work. The key fobs work. Wow. You can park the trunk. Everything works. The dome light illumination for the sun visors works. Proximity sensors work. Lane avoidance works. He's transposed a 69 Charger so well onto the 2017 Hellcat that it has no idea that it looks like a 69 Charger. So it's what his customer wanted. But the really interesting thing is that it satisfies all of the requirements for 50 state legal and if not internationally legal pollution control. And that's a big thing. Yeah. A modern muscle car, it doesn't matter if it's capable of 700 or 800 horsepower. It's got to pass smog. It's got to be unaltered when it comes to the eyes of the EPA down here. And they're really clamping down on a lot of stuff like that. EPA is changing the face of hot rodding. So this ticks a lot of boxes and it solves a lot of problems to the question of what are we going to do in 10 years for hot rodding? So TC Panic has done a couple of these builds. He did a 49 Woody on an 05 Explorer a couple of years ago. Brilliant execution. But this Hellcat Challenger was sitting behind us in primer, just out of metal, in epoxy primer. So we were talking about it because it had AMD panels all over it. They're huge in the Mopar community, and they have the best stampings out there, period. Mm. So that's one of the reasons that I like to align with them, is because their quality control on their aftermarket parts, and it's just, not just metal. They have glass, interior, upholstery, all kinds of stuff.
Really? But cool.
Their quality control is second to nobody's. So the question that I asked Dave Kindig, I said, so you take this car behind us at the stage that it's at, it's teched out. Everything is good mechanically, all the drivetrain, everything talks, everything sees itself. And now it's ready to blow apart and paint. How many hours is it going to take you if you take this car back to your shop and get it into a paint job that you can sign off on? Give me a wild guess what he said.
Like
200?
Everything? Like body off?
Or just paint?
Blow it apart, paint it inside and out, put it back together, polish, if there's graphics, whatever. From the point of metalwork up to paint.
Oh, maybe not 200. I'd say 300-400 hours.
So Dave said it was between 4,500 and 5,000 hours.
Oh, wow.
And that blew me away. So if you think about that, so 4,500, I've got a pocket calculator right here in front of me, times, let's just pick a nice round number at $100 an hour. And a lot of the high-end custom shops, their labor rates are higher than that. But I'm not going to try and say what Dave's labor rate is. It doesn't even matter. But let's just say that that's at $100 an hour.
That's 45 grand.
Yeah.
Just for paint. I shouldn't say just for, but for the paint.
That's just labor. That's not including consumables. It's not including paint. Yeah. It's not including
shop supplies. So he had a car there that he built for Kevin Hart, the comedian. And it was a 70 or 71 Challenger with the Helifant engine. And I mean, Art Morrison chassis. This thing was stunning. Stunning execution, and it was black. Black does not lie. Black is the perfect mirror for a paint job. It's the lens into what's underneath it, and it does not lie. And this car was beautiful. So I'm envisioning that. So that's another $400,000 on top of what TC had in this car to make it into what it is. So what are we talking about there? How many people can afford that? Not very many. Mm-hmm. There's a select clientele that can afford that. But it was such an interesting discussion because essentially it's the amount of follow through that these guys are afforded and allowed by their customers. I'll never forget a conversation, and I brought this up with Chip. Chip and I have been friends for a while, and Chip Foose came down to the Power Block Studios many times with the different sponsorships that he had, and he helped build a couple of cars with us. And we found him in the truck studio one time. He was in between camera takes talking to Courtney about something, and I can't remember what Magnaflow exhaust, I think, was his contract at the time. And we ended up into this discussion and talking about high-end builds and talking about the level of quality that they put out there and Fuss designs and things like that. And one of his quotes that I'll never forget, he said, "We're only as good as our customers allow us to be."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if you want to go down that rabbit hole, how close to perfect do you want, right? Because the difference between a backyard paint job or a Mako or an Earlshine paint job and a Chip Fuss paint job, it's not the techniques. It's not even the materials. It's the amount of follow through, right? It's the amount of time that you can devote into executing each task perfectly. I do training classes. I do consultation and in-person training classes for a select group of people. And I always talk about this procedure of auto body repair being very complex when you look at it as a procedure. But if you break it down to links of the chain and steps in the procedure, each step is really, really simple. Sand the panel. Paint the panel after that. It's the intricacies in the procedural chain and the execution of each individual step that make the difference between a $500,000 car and a $500 Mako paint job. It's the same paint. It's the same procedure. It's the same sandpaper. It's the same principle of mechanical adhesion, chemical adhesion, blah, 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 polishing, all that kind of stuff. The difference is in execution. And I find it fascinating. And it's a case study in the artistry of making these cars. And my opinion is this. The art involved in high-end custom cars is not even in the paint jobs. It's in the design and in the conception of it. Yeah. And how that applies and how that is applied throughout the process. Everything else is procedure. Everything else is just doing the steps, but doing them perfectly and properly before you move on to the next step and not robbing the procedure of your excellence, of mm-hmm. your, everybody knows what the right thing to do is. We all have a moral compass. We, you know, integrity is what we do when nobody's looking. So if you can go through those steps of everything with best practice, with perfect integrity, with best SOPs, and you can get it done. You know, everybody that has ever done any kind of a paint job in their backyard is capable of $1 million car, period. That's the truth. So when you look at it like that, it opens up the world to possibilities, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So what's standing in your way? Is it a paint booth? I don't know. I saw an inflatable paint booth, a good one, for about $1,500 or $1,800 at SEMA. Guess yeah. what? You're $1,800 away from having a paint booth. Now you can control your paint environment. Now you can have a job that doesn't have insects flying into it. So what's the difference between a backyard paint job and one in a booth? It's cleaner. It's better. You have more control. You have more control over your atmosphere, all of your air surrounding it. You've just upped your game for a very small investment. So those are the types of things that I like to geek out on. Those are the types of things that are they're epiphanies to me, and as a teacher and as an instructor, and frankly, somebody that tries to inspire people into taking the steps forward and investing in themselves, investing in their future, and being bold enough to try things that they've never tried before, making it clear that there's tiny little obstacles in your way that are easy to get around in order to give yourself a better shot at it and create these successes that we can only dream of from the outside.
Oh man,
you're just inspiring me already to talk about all this stuff. Oh, you can go buy a paint booth for $1,800. Hey, honey, I just took your garden out of the backyard because I bought a paint booth because Kevin said I could paint my vehicle. Yeah.
they're inflatable. Yeah. You guys can't use them in the wintertime, but you know, in the between, I don't know, April and September, then you've got a pretty good window, right?
That's cool.
Wow, that's yeah, just the advancements and stuff to enable people
yeah.
to start doing something.
And at that point, you know? There's so many barriers that are being removed. It's like you're the only one in your way now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with the advent of social media and YouTube is such a powerful tool. YouTube is the enemy of classic paint education because people can go to YouTube and get information for free. So why should they buy my DVDs? That's what I'm faced with in paint education. So I can tell you about the differences all day long. There's structured lessons, it's produced video, and it takes all the sifting out of it. I use proper PPE. There's no potty mouth stuff. You don't have to worry about your kids being in the room when somebody throws a Donald Duck fit and says bad words. My videos don't have that. They're more lesson oriented than YouTube is. And I'm saving you time if you buy my DVDs. And what's time worth? I don't know. But I'm just going to say it. You can still get great information on YouTube. My challenge is to create an environment on YouTube, which I'm working on 2024, to welcome people in and give them both of those things. And there's ways to monetize that. We can get sponsorships and we can do this thing, but I want to create an environment on YouTube that people don't have to search any further than my destination to get great instructional video, great advice, great examples of how to do these procedural things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's bust the myth that paint and body is voodoo and magic and you know, a God-given gift. It's not. It's skill. It's procedure. It's acquired mm-hmm. skill. That's all.
So now you can go get a inflatable booth, have your instruction set, your paintication, and now somebody mm-hmm. who has no idea what to do and wants to go out on a limb and try to paint something, now they've got the resources, both in the physical. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more just besides an inflatable paint booth. You need compressor, guns, and all that stuff. But you're giving them the confidence now that all this stuff is accessible so that they can now take a vehicle, whether it's a daily driver or a rust bucket, and start tinkering around and seeing if they're into it. Play around.
Well, absolutely. And here's the other thing. When I started producing Paintucation, you could bring your TV into the paint booth. Guess where your TV is now, folks? It's on your smartphone.
Yeah.
So my videos are all available streaming, as is YouTube. Available streaming. You can take it and put it in your back pocket. If you get stuck, you can dial it up on your phone and you can bring Kevin, your instructor, into your paint booth. It's this golden age that we live in of communication and visibility. And there's so many opportunities. I applaud you guys, Lance and Corey, for taking the step to produce a podcast for the purposes of bringing things into people's sphere that they may not have thought about before. So that's the power that we have as media people. Let's just call ourselves media professionals, to bring things to an audience that never would have had the chance to access it before. So I applaud you guys for doing what you're doing. It's why I come on the Builder Sessions show. And it's because it's important to bring the right message into people that are wanting to listen and willing to listen. But also, let's exercise the muscle that we have now. It's at our fingertips, virtually free, international global broadcast capabilities. Holy cow. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. That's a recent thing. Historically, I know there's people listening to this that have never been alive in this world without high-speed internet. That's fine. But when I started in the 1900s, and boy, I hate saying that, the television camera lens cost $40,000.
Wow.
Jeez.
That's what it cost to produce TV back then. Now, anybody with an iPhone or a smartphone or a nice Android, you can produce TV shows. And guess what? It's happening. Motion pictures, full-length movies are being produced on iPhone. So it's an opportunity, man. So if you've ever thought about doing anything with media, you have no excuses anymore, right?
Yeah.
Amen to that.
True. So you talked about Paintucation in 2024. Where is Paintucation going? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I've been working for about the last year and a half. I finally, last time I talked to you guys, I was pipe dreaming and putting it out into the universe. I wanted to get Paintucation into high school shop classes, into college courses in a formal way, not just here's a video, but how do I dissect and get into and help create formal curriculum that falls into place with the standards of formal collision repair training. So it's a huge question to ask. And I had no idea who to ask. And I've been asking that question for a long time. And I finally got the chance to ask the right people. And since I've figured this out, I have now, my mission statement is to create companion products that will fall into place for trade school instructors in collision repair disciplines. They will literally be drop-in modules that coincide with their mandated curriculums at the different stages of what trimester they're in with the different courseware and all that type of stuff. I'm creating interactive video teacher's aids for trade schools and high school shop programs. And what that is going to do is it will also allow students to have a portal in to do test outs. What it allows instructors to do is to bring the resource in without the fear of, and I've talked to dozens of instructors that maybe they want to show a procedure. Maybe it's a polishing procedure. Maybe it's an ADAS calibration. Maybe there's something about structural metal repair. So they sift through the internet. They try and find a video that satisfies that need for doing that. Because instructors, as you guys know, sometimes you're trapped mm-hmm. in being instructors and you don't get a chance to go out into the industry and go to SEMA and go to the trade shows and the conferences. So they're now constantly reaching out for material that's okay to bring into their classroom. And God forbid somebody says the wrong word, or maybe they're not wearing the right PPE. And then you send a mixed message to your students. And that's not good, because the subtle thing and the subliminal thing is that now, as instructors, we're sending a mixed message to somebody that says, well, maybe it's okay to paint with a half mask on when I'm using catalyzed products, and maybe I can get away with it. We don't want to do that. So what I'm doing is relieving the instructors of all of that. I have proper PPE. I've always been a very big component of being proactive and safe while we're doing this stuff. Live to spray another day. So I'm creating instructional lessons that they don't have to worry about whether it's being whether I'm sending the wrong message, or whether students are getting, you know, a different mixed message on what proper SOPs are, what best practice is. It's all laid out there, and it's literally designed in conjunction with the 5 new standards of fundamental collision repair that are being mandated by ASE and ICAR and throughout trade schools in the United States and high school shop programs as well. So I didn't know what to do when I talked to you guys last. I know I wanted to do it. Now I know what to do. So I'm so excited about this. I've got 2 colleges that are going to be prototype for my curriculum when it gets out. They're giving me feedback as I send them lessons. So I'm literally dialing this in. And at some point of this year, we're going to be doing a big marketing push, trying to get it out there into the world that this training is now available. And I'm using interactive video. I love video. I'm a visual learner. I always have been. And I love video. But linear video, the challenge with that is that we have a short attention span. You guys can speak to this as instructors. There's a very short attention span with people watching video. And social media has trained us into that. It's about 2.5 minutes. So with interactive video, it does 2 things. It breaks up that attention span. It gives something to focus on. It gives an interactivity that takes a passive observer and turns them into an active participant. Now, what I'm talking about with interactivity is if I'm transitioning from I'm doing a block sanding session on some primer surfacer. Now we're going to guide coat and move up to the next stage of sanding. Now we can ask the question, what grade of sandpaper do we go to next, A or B? If it's A, then that's correct. We move on to the lesson, show the procedure. If it's B, if the student and or the instructor makes the wrong decision, was it B, there's a buzzer sound, nope, and here's why. Mm. So now we have cause and effect that doesn't cost anybody their ego. It doesn't cost anybody embarrassment, and they get to learn. And then we circle back and ask the question again. Now we know better. Now we train into proper procedure, proper SOP, best practice philosophies, best mindset, and locking in those chains of procedure on a very subliminal level. And it gamifies the whole thing. So it's a really interesting concept. And the people that I've shown it to on a prototype level are very, very interested in it. So I feel like I'm on the right path. I feel like I've figured out something. I haven't invented interactive video. What I've done is taken and applied it to technical training, and I'm very excited about that. I don't even care if I'm the first one, but I'm doing it, and I'm doing it well, because I'm taking advantage of all the tools that have been given to me to create the proper training with the proper mindset, and I'm just trying to do it right. And again, I'm super excited about it. So that's kind of my babble on about that.
I love it. It's really nice that teachers don't have to vet it. You've already vetted it, right? That's the whole thing.
Yes.
Because the whole idea, the sifting through and checking, that's going to save instructors millions of minutes, like
hours
and day, like just thinking of like, even in my other classes that I teach, okay, I got to show a movie. Well, I have to watch the movie first to make sure,
yeah. That,
you know, like even if it's a full length feature in my classroom or a film study, I have to watch that movie before I watch the movie with the class, you know?
Right.
And so there's a lot of things, those little nuances that not a lot of people think about. It's really nice and refreshing to know that you've taken those into consideration as well and are doing some of that background work for them. And that's going to save them a ton of time.
Absolutely it is. And, you know, think about this. If you have a tablet, you know, the course where I'm designing is designed to maybe have a meeting in the morning. Today, we're going to talk about panel replacement, blah, blah, blah. Let's watch what Kevin says. There's a 10-minute video interactivity. We get up to speed, and then they go apply that out on the floor somewhere. So imagine if you can bring a tablet, dial it back in. Hey, guys, you know, did you put your cavity wax in after that weld on the quarter panel? Or, did you know, remember what Kevin said here? It gives you the tool to go back in and circle back on some instructional processes that you may not have. You don't have to bring everything back into the classroom. So I want to create tools that benefit instructors for the best possible way. So the ironic thing is this. I was in a Zoom meeting or a Teams meeting with people at ICAR talking about training and development, and they're going through major changes as well. So I'm hoping to be able to work with ICAR and ASC in the near future as well, both as an ally and an asset to them. But there was a panel, I was probably 7 or 8 people on the Teams panel, and we were just signing off, thanks guys, let's talk soon, blah, blah, blah. And one of the instructors, one of the guys that actually creates curriculum in ICAR, said, hey, Kevin, before we go, I just wanted to say thanks. When I first started as a trade school teacher X amount of years ago, he said, I was green, I didn't know what to do, and I needed some help. So I bought your instructional videos from Eastwood, and they helped me in my first 11 months of being an instructor, create lesson plans, show the students something. He said, so I just wanted to thank you for what you're doing and what you have done. It almost brought me to tears because it was such a humbling moment, and I felt so appreciated and I felt inspired and I felt like I had actually helped. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had no idea the reach that something like that would have when I first started this company. And it was an amazing thing for me to hear and for somebody to say out loud. And honestly, it empowers me to this day and propels me forward in trying to do better and trying to reach higher and trying to reach more people. And the irony of all of that was my question of how do I get into high school shop classes? How do I get into colleges with my training? I guess I've already been there. I guess I've been there for quite a while now, but now we can formalize it. And now I can be part of the advertised picture. Now I can be part of the actual curriculum. So it's super exciting. And it's literally the next evolution of this wonderful industry that has paid me back and done so much for me over the course of the years that I've been in it.
That is the interactivity part, I think, for... We talk about, I mean, our specialization would be high school. So let's take it at that. But the part where if somebody answers, because I've got Moodle stuff, I've got all my stuff on safety and, you know, online, they have to take quizzes. When they get it wrong, though, there's no explanation. So when they are going through and you're working through a process, whether it's woodworking, I mean, this could be across any trade. When you get it wrong, this is the reason why. Mm-hmm. And now that's giving them information instead of just, oh, I got it wrong, I got to go do it. Oh, I remember that question. I picked A last time, so I'm going to pick B.
Yeah.
This is why. Yeah. Why are you, you know, whatever the question is.
And a visual.
Yeah, yeah. Like that's, yeah. I feel like that's a game changer.
It's huge.
Powerful stuff. And it also does this, you know, sometimes getting it wrong out on the floor means somebody gets hurt, mm-hmm. right? So maybe, if I'm just spotting in this panel over here, maybe I can just do it with a half mask and glasses, true or false. You know, that's literally an interactive stepping point in one of the videos. If somebody does that and creates a habit of doing that, I've had friends that have been chased out of the industry because of allergies to polyisocyanate. Mm-hmm. That can mean a career choice for somebody. It can mean somebody going into anaphylactic shock if they're very allergic to some of the chemistry that we've got to work with. So maybe that interactive moment trains them to not ever really flirt with that thing. And maybe it saves somebody from having an accident out into the shop, and God forbid out into your schools where you train. Nobody wants to get hurt. Even, you know, even the people that are trying to save time and skirt some of the procedures. So I think it's a powerful thing on that level. And as an instructor, my thought was, if I, you know, I call them teachable moments, and I didn't invent the phrase, but if you have a teachable moment where something goes horribly wrong, now that's a powerful thing. We don't learn from success. We learn from failure.
Right.
There's nothing to be learned by getting it right. Let's move on. And the opportunity to fail is literally the teachable moment. So if there's a transition in a video and I'm going, you know, down the chain of procedure, and I give somebody the choice of making the wrong choice, there, you as an instructor, now you have a teachable moment.
Yep.
You pause the video, you don't move on to it, you relate your own personal experience, and then you can move on with the lesson. So it gains you credibility as well in that moment. And if everything jihas and coincides, and my message is the same as the trade school's message, it becomes a wonderful learning tool. And I'm so looking forward to getting better feedback and doing this and actually getting it out there.
It would almost benefit even for those people, like you said. I was thinking about this as you were talking, as far as the people who get the question right, be like, okay, so why was B wrong? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And yeah. Then show that so that they can see that too, so that everyone's on the same page, so that they don't miss out on that really good opportunity to learn.
And they're building those foundational skill sets when they choose, if they choose the correct answer or wrong, and you tie it back into either this is why A was wrong or why is B right? You know, like you're having that conversation, that's kind of getting ingrained into them. Oh, right. You know, standing a panel or whatever, PPE. Oh, right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's the stuff that sticks.
One of my private consultation and training contracts brings people to me that are degreed engineers, and they need to study refinished materials application. So you get a certain elevation of an analytical mind with a degreed engineer, and saying, yes, this is correct, that's not good enough. They want to know why it's correct, and they want to know the science and the discipline and the chemistry behind why it's correct. And so the right answer, sometimes it's good to move on, but sometimes you have to know why it's the right answer as well and how it works in order for people to put those pieces together and lock it down and make it part of their personal SOP.
And it's like you're grabbing them by the collar, be like, slow down. Yeah, you got it right. We're not flipping through a social media feed here. Like, let's just sit in this for a second. Because, like you said, our squirrel brains are really trained at this point. What's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? I want to get in the shop. I want to get in the shop. Well,
absolutely.
We're going
to
learn.
If I'm doing the paint job, I want to spray the paint.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's the last 5% of the paint job.
Yeah.
You know, that's the application of the lens. That's it. So you asked me about a day in the life, and, you know, you like to shadow me and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you how exciting my life was yesterday. So I get up. I get a little bit of a workout in. Not enough. And I come here, I answer a bunch of emails, and I ended up, what did I do? I sifted through B-roll for, I'm using GPR, glue repair. And so I've got a bunch of B-roll and a couple of glue repairs that I did, and I'm putting together just the linear lesson, and then I plug in the interactivity afterwards. So I spent the first 3 hours sifting through B-roll, naming clips, getting them ready to import into my editing suite. I had a quick lunch, and then I started importing video into Premiere Pro, which is the editing software that I use, organizing my bins, getting, and I'm saying words that people may not understand, but basically getting the big chunks of video into a place where I can find them and drag them onto what's called the timeline, which is where you put everything together. And that took me until about 2 o'clock. Then I realized I needed, as I'm putting together, it was a glue pole repair. As I'm putting together, we have video with no audio on it. This is instructional. Now we have to have audio. I've got all the pretty pictures and great video, but now there's no instruction. So now I have to go back, write my voiceover script. Then I have to record the voiceovers. And then I have to import the voiceovers back in onto my computer, because you can't read off the card because it's unstable. Yeah. You got to put it onto a hard drive. You got to make sure you got space on the hard drive. Then it goes imported back into Premiere Pro and then back into the bin. Now I can drag and drop my voiceovers. And then I have to place them perfectly, time them in with the video. And all of a sudden, it's about 4:30, where I had a podcast that I did at 5 o'clock. And so after my podcast ended at 5 o'clock, I got to talk to some wonderful entrepreneurs and I was a guest expert on media training techniques, how to talk into the camera and how to be an effective communicator. It was a really fun thing to do. So I wanted to do it because it supports a good friend of mine. And then I come back in and I finished editing and I think I got home about 8 o'clock. So if that's exciting to you, that's a typical day in my world as I know it these days.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous.
And that's been on and off for 24 years now. Hey, yeah. You've been doing that. Like, wow. The work ethic.
It's not every day that that happens. There are times where I get up in the morning and say, what do I want to do today? But it's rare. You know, if you really want to do stuff, you have to be planned and methodical. You have to, I go by a Google calendar and you have to plan your day out. You know, and people see on social media the highlights of what it is that I do. 5-6 days ago, I was in Gainesville, Georgia at AMD headquarters, and we were in their R&D department where they're making new panels and reverse engineering Ford pickup trucks and all this great stuff. And they had all these amazing cars, and it's such a cool thing to be a part of that team. That was a 5-hour drive there and then a couple of days back. So I get to do stuff like that. People that follow me on social media get to see me pop up. Hey, KT's at AMD headquarters. Look at that. It's a Hemi CUDA. Isn't that fun? Wow, boy, he gets to do all this cool stuff. So, and those things are true. But the price you pay for that is being all over the place and going to PRI and coming back. And a day after I got back from PRI, I was supposed to go to Georgia and do that very same video. And I came down with the flu. You're at a trade show with 50,000 people. Guess what's going to happen? You're going to shake some hands. You're going to walk past people in the hallway. And that's what happens, you know. And that put me down for 2 or 3 days. I felt like crap and, you know, I had to get back up to speed. And then I lost those 2 or 3 days. So now you got to catch up and all that kind of stuff. So. Yeah.
They don't see it when you're sitting in a parking lot, a gas station parking lot, eating a gas station egg salad sandwich at 2 a.m.
Uh-huh.
And you still got 100 miles to go before you get home too, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's so luxurious and flashy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. I can't believe the life I get to lead. But there's a bunch of work, and I like work. I've always liked work. You know, my high school jobs in summers and spring breaks, I figured out a long time ago that you get out of work what you put into it, and work is its own reward. And picking fruit in the summertime, that's what we did. I grew up in the Okanagan, and we followed the fruit as it went through the summertime. That was my summer job. And in spring break, we were tying grapevines. And in the fall, we were picking apples. And that's hard work. And when you're a little kid, you'd rather be out riding your bike, but you're picking fruit. Why? Because you want a better bike, you know?
Yeah.
So those things taught me those life lessons. And, you know, I grew up and dad was gone and we didn't have very much money. And so if I wanted a car, we had to get a job. And there's, you know, it taught me that there's nothing wrong with that. It taught me resourcefulness from a very early age. And I could have resented it. And I suppose I did. As we grow up, we look at things with different eyes. Now I look back at my childhood with adult eyes. But when I was in it, I was resentful of a lot of things. And I had my trouble. And I got into trouble as a teenager, did stupid things. I got in trouble with the law, like everybody does. We go through our curve. But as I look back at it now, all of those mistakes, all of those insecurities, they're all tools, man. They're all things that if we can look at in the proper way, we can grow from them and we can see our growth. And that's really important, man. We talked about ego before we started recording this. And ego is such a powerful tool when you can actually own the power that you have.
Yeah.
And it's an important thing. We have to be forward. We can't just sit back and wish we did something. We can't sit back and wring our hands and say, man, I'd sure like to do a podcast, but I don't know. What if people don't like it?
Yeah.
That stops people in their tracks. I don't like how I look on when I do a live on Facebook. I don't like the sound of my voice when I do an interview. And it stops people from doing it. When the truth is, you just got to get over it and get used to it. Because, you know, the secret is this. And I talked about this last night in my little media class that I gave. People get insecure about how they look and how they feel and how they sound and the sound of their voice and all that kind of stuff. That's within you. That's your perception. And if you're listening to this, listen to me carefully. People already know what you sound like and people already know what you look like. And it's okay. You're the one that's insecure with what you sound like and what you look like. So get past yourself. Practice into a camera. Practice the and listening back to the sound of your voice, and you'll figure, you'll get used to it, and you'll get past that threshold of being insecure about what it is that you can do. And hopefully that will empower you to start a podcast, or at least, you know, do a live video, not just a selfie where you take 75 different shots and pick the best one. That's not a real representation.
No, that's
posing, you know, and there's value in that, I suppose. And, you know, you want to have the best shot and your best angle and all the light and all that kind of stuff. And, but to me, if you're really going to express yourself some way, you just got to get used to how you are, and just be brave and be bold and throw it out there. Right.
Authenticity is really, it connects people, right? People,
it's
real.
People, and
it's real.
It's hard to get in touch with, to be your authentic self. And the big V word that's such a viral thing these days, vulnerability. What does vulnerability mean? Well, what does it mean to you guys to be vulnerable in a public sense?
Showing your true self to strangers as far as a public sense.
Being able to acknowledge weaknesses, being able to acknowledge the fact that we're not all perfect. Being vulnerable is to be honest. You don't have to break into tears when you're vulnerable. You don't have to tell your worst secrets to be vulnerable. You just have to acknowledge that you're on a path just like everybody else is, and you know, you can meet people where they are, and being vulnerable to me is just being truthful.
I like that.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm checking off these boxes. Not liking how you sound and how you look online. So that's some stuff I got to get over, because that's getting into this podcast stuff.
A producer told me one time, we were doing, and I was practicing, it's called a stand-up, which is you're swearing to camera and you deliver a line, maybe 15, 20, 30 seconds. And it's called, in the industry, it's called a stand-up. So, and I was crashing and burning and I was nervous and I was, you know, and so we got it right finally. And he looked at me and he said, yep, that's going to be good. I was so happy that I got through the stand-up without flubbing a word. I said, what do you mean it's going to be good? He said, the skin will burn off. Let's do it again. And so what that meant, what he was telling me, is now I've got the building blocks to say the message that I was trying to say. Now I can make it, now I can take it and make it look relaxed. Now I can make it look instructional. Now I can pump up my energy a little bit and make it look like I'm excited about it, because I am excited about it, because it's a cool thing I'm doing to a car. I'm showing you guys how to section a fender, whatever it was. But that really, it really lit the light bulb in my head. It was an epiphany for me. The skin is going to burn off. And I use that phrase frequently. The skin does burn off. We get used to, we get tired of being insecure because it's boring as hell. And we can now just get past it because it's something that, you know, whatever. That's I'm bored with being uneasy about it. So let's just move on.
Yeah. Has anyone, while you're talking about this, I had a thought. It's like, has anyone ever come up to you in real life telling you they don't like your voice? Or they don't.
Yes.
Or they don't like. Oh, really? That's not what I was going for.
Yeah. So it was the first season of Trucks. And me and Ryan Shand, there was a Good Guys car show. And a Good Guys has almost 30 different car shows. And they're huge events. So we're at the the Titan Stadium in Nashville. And me and Ryan are walking around with a production crew. It was the first season of us. Stacey David had left the show. And he had his own show, Gears. And this guy comes up to us, and I'll imitate his voice. He comes up to us and says, hey, I got one question for you guys. What did you do with Stacey? You guys suck.
Did your jaw drop?
Yeah. You're
like, I looked at him and said, well,
I love you too. Yeah.
Stacey's on his own now. You can find him. His show is called Gears, and he's on a different network now. And you know, just keep watching. He said, we're, you know, and Ryan said, yeah, we're trying to make good shows and, you know, build off what Stacey had. And I think the guy just ended up walking away from us. But, you know, so it was like, wow, we got some work to do.
Yeah.
We got to win that guy back.
Yeah.
And if we ever win him back, I'll never know. But all we did was try and make the best TV shows that we could make and go forward with that, knowing that there's always going to be haters. There's always going to be people that you know, are pissed off because you moved the carrots on their plate. Their carrots used to be at 10 o'clock. Now they're at 3 o'clock. And dang it, I want my carrots back at 10 o'clock. And it's your fault that they got moved in the first place. People want their comfort zone. And I get that. I completely understand that. But the truth is, you can't make everybody happy. And if you find yourself thinking that you do, you're not doing enough. You're not being bold enough. If you don't have haters and trolls, you are not doing this right. You're not saying
you're not
anything
making waves
to get people's attention.
Yeah.
Nobody can satisfy everybody all at once. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And truly, one of the indicators that you're doing something right is that people notice you enough to complain about it or say something weird online. It's a team sport these days.
Yeah.
I'm a member of an auto body forum on or the user group on Facebook. They have 245,000 members. It's a huge platform. Man, I feel bad for some of the questions that get asked there because guys are brutal. You get these lifers that are in there and they take such delight in beating people down. I don't participate in that. I don't subscribe to it. And I'll come to these guys' defense sometimes. But that's the world we live in.
Yeah.
You're not going to change those guys. The keyboard warrior is going to be there. I don't care.
Yeah.
Because here's one of the things that I've found. In my tenure of going to SEMA, I didn't go to SEMA this year, but I've been for the past 22 years prior to that. So trade shows and all that kind of stuff, you're going to run into people that maybe they recognize you from a TV show. Maybe they wrote or read a tech article that you wrote. Maybe they have one of your videos. They're going to come up to you and say, hey, I watched your TV show. I like what you do. That could be the same guy that's trolling you on social media. You're never going to know.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
So the truth in that is that it's the same guy that likes you that maybe for whatever reason, they now think it's going to be, they're going to get some yucks or get a reaction and a laughy face at their comment when they beat you to death on social media. Get over it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep with your mission. Keep moving forward. And this is for all the people that are listening that are even thinking about doing Facebook posts or putting themselves out there. It doesn't matter. Don't wrap your investment of your self-worth in other people's failings. Mm. It's not going to serve you at all. You got to ignore it. It's noise. So
yep.
Get past it and just keep on moving forward. Don't subscribe to the hate.
Love it. So when you were talking about the start of, like the last time you were on the show, you said you had a pipe dream you tossed out into the universe. And I just want to talk a little bit about that pipe dream, but on a general sense, this whole big pic, because you're a real big picture guy, right? You're a big picture guy, and that's why I feel like I understand you, and I feel like you understand me, and it's like, this guy thinks the way I think, and that makes my thinking okay. But like, as far as big picture, not being because there's a lot of people who kind of forget about that whole, because it's a necessity, right? And we're not just like pie in the sky people, and everyone balances themselves out. But do you want to talk a little bit about how the big picture is important and that concept of back timing and just like how you having these goals, you need that goal, you need that direction in life?
I would love to talk about this, and it's really super important. We have to have goals. We have to have dreams. And there's nothing wrong with liking where you are.
Mm-hmm.
With being complacent with where you are in life. If you're truly happy, that's a beautiful thing. I know people that are farmers and they love being farmers and they'll roll with the punches of a bad crop and they truly love what it is that they do and their sense of family and all that kind of stuff. And there's nothing wrong with liking what you're doing. But I've always been a dreamer. I've always been somebody that wants something more than what's in front of me. And you know, we can dig a hole and figure out what those reasons are and dig into my psyche, but I don't think this is the time for that. Let's just say that I've always been a dreamer and I've always had big goals. One of my goals as a little kid was that I wanted to be, before grade school, I wanted to be like Donny Osmond. And then in grade school, and I got introduced to rock and roll, I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be Freddie Mercury or David Lee Roth from Van Halen. I wanted to be a rock star. And it was a huge dream for me. And I was in Oliver, British Columbia with one blinking traffic light. And that's not where you are. That's not where you're going to be a rock star.
What do you
mean? You might become a local guy. Yeah. So what do you do to become a rock star? Well, you start asking questions and you figure it out and you figure out what the plan is. Because if you just sit there and wish it, it's, you know, there's no such thing as tangible magic. Harry Potter, guess what? None of us have the wand. It's fun to watch. And when we, you know, we can read the books and we can sit and meditate and try and manifest things. If we just sit there and wish it, we can't will it into existence. There's certain things that have to happen to make things a reality. If anybody on the planet hasn't watched the Michael Jordan special on his career, in the title is, it's something about the game or something like that. And I quote it many times. I can't believe my short-term memory is failing me now. But it's a case study in setting goals, visualizing, executing the tasks in which to complete the goals, back timing, and then realizing what it is that you've achieved. Michael Jordan decided he was going to be the best player in the NBA. So you don't just sit there and all of a sudden that happens to you. He figured out what it took, what kind of training it took. He's going to be better than everybody else. What's everybody else doing? Well, you got to do more than that. And you got to do it better than them. So you first have to figure out what your competition is doing. So there's math involved in setting goals, literally. And here's my example of that. In 2012, I had the opportunity to display a car at SEMA. It was a car that I was building. It was the first time I was going to have a vehicle that I built on the floor in Hot Rod Alley at the most visible, prestigious part of this world's greatest automotive trade show. And one of my cars was going to be out there. I made the commitment at the prior SEMA. I said, yeah, I can get it done. At the time, I was full-time with Trucks TV. At the time, I was Paint Chucation was in the heyday of DVD distribution. We had 11 catalog distributors, and then that was a full-time job in itself. Lots of Saturdays, lots of evenings, lots of early mornings. My wife is an entrepreneur. She had a small business. I would help her when I could. So needless to say, our carts were full. I found myself in about April of the next year, still with this commitment, with a car that was 30% built. And now November comes up. And if you've ever talked to somebody that's built a car to be displayed at SEMA show, this thing happens. It's called SEMA Thrash. And it's the last little rush of what it is that you have to do to get the car done to be displayed properly on the floor at SEMA show. And it's really, really important to get there. And at that point, you can't back out. You've made commitments. I've got sponsored parts. You have to display it. There's going to be a magazine out there that's going to cover the car for you. And all these things were coming into play. Everything was converging on SEMA show. Failure is not an option. Just like the movie, failure was not an option. So I went to a good friend of mine and I said, TC Pennick, I said, I'm in trouble. I need some help with this car. Here's the stage of it. He came down to my shop and he looked at it and he was literally wringing his forehead with his hands going, man, this is a lot of work to do this like you want to do it. He said, but I think we can get it done. I'm going to help you. He shut down his custom shop for 4.5 months. And we recruited help of other people. We exercised the power of compound labor. I may have taken a few afternoons off every once in a while from the production studio. And I poured every ounce of energy and time into making this car happen. And we barely got it done. We put 4,000 labor hours in a period of March, April, May, June, July. It ended up being about 5 months. We got the car done. It was a hit out at SEMA, and it cost me a lot of personal relationships, and it was the closest I've ever come to damaging my marriage. And I've been married for 34 years now, and that was a mistake, and I see that. It was a very costly thing to do. So we got it done. Here's how we got it done. TC Panic puts this calendar up on a dry erase board. He drew it out and he had milestones all the months, all the weekends, all the time to our deadline, which was the transport truck in Tennessee. We had, it's probably a 2-day run out to Las Vegas where SEMA show was. So you have to be 2 weeks. Really, that's your deadline, is 2 weeks before the show for the transport truck to come pick it up. They're going to route around the country, pick up the other 6 vehicles in the back of the transport truck and bring it out there. And then you got to be there before setup day to drop it off, all kinds of stuff. So your deadline is not the show. It's weeks before the show. So we had our deadline. We had the end game. We had to be finished by X date. So what do we have to do? Here's our tasks. Now we have a task list. We have our calendar on one side, a task list on the next side. We take the tasks, write them out in methodical order. Let's just say there was 40. So we take our calendar halfway between May and September is when. So we figured out what that date was. Then we transpose that over to our task list. So by halfway point, we need to be on fitting glass. Now we transpose that onto the calendar. Now you take each of those halves. Now we've got our build cut in half. We know what we have to be at the halfway point. Have to. So now what does it take to get to the halfway point? Let's start where we are and move up to the halfway point. What's the halfway point between that? Well, that's high build primer and blocking. Okay, so now we need to, now we know where we need to be a month in. So again, we take the other half from the halfway point to the finish date. Where do we need to be? We need to be polishing paint and doing a wheel alignment and dialing in little touch-up paints kind of stuff at that halfway point. So you see where I'm going? You divide it into chunks. And so what we did is we had four milestones that we had to make. Now, there's a lot of space in between those milestones because we're talking weeks and weeks of build that we had to do. There's parts that had to come in. We had to advance order parts in order to be on the dyno to tune in the ECU and all that kind of stuff. We had to have the computer for the fuel injection system. We had to have the transmission in place. We had to have the interior out of the interior shop because we did a full custom interior as well. So those things have to happen. So you start to fill in those blanks. And what that did was it taught me not only task-oriented milestone achieving, but it taught me that it's achievable. It was this insurmountable thing that we didn't have enough time for. But when we broke it down into those increments and those milestones and those markers in time that we had to achieve, it made it possible. Because when we took our task list and applied it to the calendar, it gave us individual goals every 2 or 3 days. Now, how do we get those goals? If we have 6 hours to work and we've got 10 hours worth of work or 15 hours worth of work or 20 hours worth of work, guess what we're doing? I'm calling my buddies, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm getting help in. And if we find ourselves with 2 days after we finish the task, now we can apply it to the next one and we can get ahead of the timing curve. So that's my version of what Michael Jordan did in the dance. And you know, it was a huge thing. And what it is, we visualized, oh, this is going to be great. I had an artist rendering done of the car. I knew what it was going to look like in my head before even we had that done. So this goal that was just so overwhelming, I couldn't stand it. And it caused me ulcers. And I ended up losing about 15 pounds that summer because I didn't allow myself time to eat. And what back timing did, starting from the halfway point to the quarters, to the eighth, to the 16th, to daily tasks, it taught me how to manifest that, literally will it into shape. Now, did I sit there on day one and dream about it and then wake up in September and the car was done? Heck no. Mm-hmm. We worked very hard right from the task one, but we had to know what the tasks were. We had to know what the roadmap was. And it was a very valuable lesson to me that TC knew inherently, and he taught it to me. And he made that car possible. There's no magic to it. There's nothing magical about it. But the truth is, I visualized it. I dreamt it up. I made the commitment. And we put it into place slowly and methodically with best practice SOPs. And we reached our goal. And so it broke down something that was a dream and made it into a reality just by applying what we knew we had to do to it. So you take any kind of a goal. What do you want to be? I want to be a lawyer. Well, how do you become a lawyer? You don't just sit there at home and read a bunch of books and all of a sudden you're a lawyer.
You watch Suits, right? You watch. Yeah. You could do the. You could just do challenge the test. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. So no, you go to law school, right? And then you do prep for law school. Maybe you got to get a scholarship, whatever. So there's a plan for that. You have the wonderful apprenticeship program in Canada to where you can become a journeyman and have field experience as well as the tutelage from great college instructors. And when you hit the ground running with your journeyman certificate, then you are a skilled worker already, granted a little green, you still got, you know, on the job training to do, but it's a really nice head start. But you know that that's a 2-year commitment, right? Mm-hmm. At least,
yeah.
You know, and if you're going to go to, you know, what does a journeyman certificate take? I'm asking, is 4 years?
Yeah.
Depending on the trade. Yeah. Welding's 3, 4 for most. And then there's, I think the auto body, there's a 5th for painter.
Interesting.
Think or 3 to 4 for painter, but yeah, usually 3 or 4.
Right. But when you come out the other side of that, you're a skilled trades worker. You're yeah. you're not just pushing the broom and watching and hoping to learn from everybody else in the shop. You can literally be put onto tasks and customer repair jobs. So yeah. It's a system that I wish we had down here, but it just won't scale. There's too many people here to make that financially feasible for the country and for institutions. There are programs. There are private programs that are modeled after European and Canadian apprenticeship models, and I'm proud that that's happening. There's companies, I think Lincoln Tech is doing stuff like that as well. So private enterprise is helping backfill that need for skilled trades workers in this country. So it's good to see that stuff hanging around or coming to pass.
I like the big picture and then the calendar and the task list. To me, that just connects everything. Okay, I'm going to take my calendar, whatever the goal is, whether it's personal, work related, like you can take any goal, create a task list. And then from that task list, divide it into time on how
I love it.
This one task needs 8 hours to complete. Now you're looking like it's and from teaching the chunking, breaking things into smaller, more manageable pieces that in our situation students can retain. But anybody with a goal, this just seems like a really easy, life manageable lesson. Way to break a big picture down into something that you can actually accomplish
into 1,000 small pictures.
Yeah, exactly.
See, it's where we can connect now because I'm Mr. Big Picture Pie in the Sky and you're Mr. Detail. And now we can come together.
Right? Because that's the thing. Lots of people get stuck, and I'm the same way. You got these big dreams, and how do you break it into those smaller pieces? For me now, even just the keyword, the task list. All right, my next goal, done. I'm putting a task list, going to go with the calendar, timeline it. That's you've just eased my brain of goal setting now.
Well,
Kevin,
what a great
thank
conversation
you.
To have on January the 3rd.
Yeah.
Well, here's the other thing. You know, I'm glad I've eased your brain, but I'm going to ease it again. We had a hard deadline to build that car and to satisfy all the elements that we needed to satisfy. But if you realize at your halfway point that you're not going to see your time goal, you're not going to make that time goal, then you can adjust. Mm-hmm. And maybe you add another month onto the end of it. There's nothing wrong with that. Because as it happens, whether it's a construction project, if you're flipping a house, if you've got an HVAC repair that you want to do, or if you're building a custom car, restoring a car, sometimes you find things, most of the time you find things that you didn't expect to find and that adds on to your task list. So forgive yourselves if you find yourself of being behind the eight ball. That's not a failure. It's just more discovery. Mm-hmm. So if you have a hard deadline, that's one thing. And the truth is, for the car, there was some electrical stuff. We didn't have the cooling fan wired in. We got funneled out into the SEMA parade after we got off the floor Friday afternoon. The whole thing shuts down at 4:30. It's magical. It's fantastic. And there's the parade cars that go out into the display. There's literally grandstands set up. It's the big SEMA parade. I wanted no part of it because the car wasn't finished. We had a vacuum leak and the cooling fan wasn't wired in. But TC put the ECU in. He had a hard lead into the center console. We got directed by traffic into the SEMA parade. Well, it's stop and go traffic for about an hour and a half.
Oh no.
On a high performance muscle car with no cooling fan. Guess what's going to happen?
Yeah.
It's going to overheat. So between us borrowing a piece of wire, a piece of like whatever, you know, 16 gauge wire, hardwiring the cooling fan into the backside of one of the pins on the ECU, we literally stopped at a drink machine, got about 6 bottles of water, poured it into the radiator, and we limped our way through the SEMA parade going, yeah, we were ready for this. We intended this. Now the car's just fine.
It's been Don't ready for months. Way. Yeah.
But that's literally what happened. So we had things to do when the car got back home. Here's another fun story about that. Got the car back home. My brother-in-law, a good friend of mine that I used to work with in collision shops, we're over here. The car finally got delivered back, and it was, I'm going to say, it's probably in early December, maybe the end of November. Car's sitting on the floor. I wiped it off. It looks great. Stupid thing won't start. I'm going, dang it. Car won't start. You know, and then it just dies. It's fuel injected. There's something wrong. There's something wrong with the wiring, something wrong with the computer, blah, blah, blah. So everybody's looking around. Oh, it looks great. You know, and my buddy Carson said, fire it up. So it's not going to start. It hadn't started. Fire it up. And it stumbled and then it just died. And he said, sounds like it's out of gas. I had forgotten that on the way up into the transport truck, we realized there was no fuel in the tank. We put 4 gallons in the tank. That's all we had time for. So running it in and out of the transport truck, SEMA, the SEMA parade, downtown Las Vegas, meeting up with the trucks, the driver offloading it, loading it back up again, and then finally into my shop. Guess what? It's a supercharged 4.6 liter engine. It burned up that 4 gallon. The stupid thing was out of gas. It never occurred to me that I had to put gas in the thing. You put 5 gallons of gas in the thing, and it never stopped running. And it was funny. And it was one of those things I was embarrassed, but it was like, okay, I'm really glad nothing else is horribly wrong. But, you know, I'm an idiot.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
That's awesome.
Good stories, hey?
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
What a great way to start the year, especially with goal setting and just kind of sharing or listening to your stories about, you know, what's next for Paint Education and this, you know, the how your goal, it's literally a case that your life is a case study on how goal setting and preparedness and setting goals and chunking them out and being intentional about all that, it works. So I just want to say thank you for sharing that, for coming on. You've definitely inspired me. I think Hoff and I need to have a chat about the next year of the show and then
what are
our goals and everything like that. But Kevin, I just want to say thank you so much for taking time again to come on and give us an update of where you're at and just share some of your awesome knowledge with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you guys too. Thank you again for having me on. Again, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you on a professional level, but I won't go into details, but I want to thank you guys for being a true friend and touching base with me. 2023 for me was very challenging on a personal level. Had a lot of personal stuff and a lot of things that were very, very hard. You guys reached out a couple of different times, and I just appreciate that very much. So thank you guys for not only having a great podcast, but for being good humans, too. It means a lot.
Well, that means a lot.
From you. Yeah, thank you.
Really appreciate it. I mean, that's just kind of how we were raised, so which is a good thing, I guess. Is there anything else you want to promote? Where can people find your new stuff? You want to direct them to any new sites or anything? Here's the time.
Well, please subscribe to my YouTube channel. We're going to get a whole lot more content up there. It's Paint Education by Kevin Tates on YouTube. My Instagram handle is at Paint Tates, PAINTETZ or Z. I've got three different Facebook pages. One is Hands on Cars with Kevin Tates. One is just Kevin Tates, my personal page. And I've got a Paint Education page as well. So find me on the socials. I'm all over there. One of my New Year's resolutions, and I do allow myself to have these because let's face it, those are goals to set as well. And they're goals that can be achieved, is I'm going to have a lot more social media presence and get what I'm doing out to you guys. I've been in the bunkers with my elbows up for the last year and a half, and I'm so excited to share what I've been working on with everybody else. And I don't know, there's lots to talk about, and it's a really interesting time, like I said, in social media. So look for me out on the socials. I would really appreciate it if anybody would subscribe to my YouTube channel, check in with me there. I'm working with AMD. They have a huge social media presence. We're going to be doing tech videos with them, work with them in their R&D, developing new products, and going out to a whole bunch of car shows, and lots of live streams are in the future. So find me on the social media stuff. Everybody, you can go to my website, www.painteducation.com. On the right-hand column, there's a contact tab. Pull that down. It will pull up info@painteducation.com. It's a direct line. I get that email just like I get Kevin@painteducation.com. If anybody has any questions about Paint Education, or if you just need some help troubleshooting some stuff, I make myself available to people that have bought Paint Education and people that never will buy Paint Education. We're here to share this information. It's my honor to share information and do what I can to help other people that might find themselves in a pickle. So please reach out. Whether you buy a DVD, that's great. If you buy a stream, that's great. If you buy the Paint Education University course, it's an excellent course. That's great. If you don't, if you just find yourself in trouble, find me. I'll help all I can.
Incredible.
Wow. You're a great human being,
Life
Kevin.
Life of service.
Hey, thank you for everything. You Absolutely. Inspire people. You keep people going, whether they're, you know, they buy your product or not. You're just, I think, the your sharing of knowledge and wisdom is at the forefront, which is really cool to see.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. But the givingness is, I'm going to call it self-serving, because one of the things I've figured out over the years is that if you go out of your way to genuinely help people and you give an honest, sincere answer, it typically, about half the time, that person will circle back and buy one of your products. And that has been proven to me over and over and over again. So I'm going to call it self-serving. Maybe it's just good karma. I don't know. But for me, it's worth the 7 minutes it's going to take to craft an answer and give somebody good technical information and help steer them on the right path. And if it doesn't, okay.
You did what the
right
thing.
What harm did we do?
You
so
did the
what?
Right
I
thing.
Lost seven yeah. minutes out of my day.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did the right thing.
Yeah. Do the right thing. Integrity is what we do when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I did. ASE has me doing webinars, and I'm very proud to be associated with that company on a different level. And so we've got another one coming up. And I'm a keynote speaker at their annual conference. It'll be in Minneapolis this year, but I got to speak on the topic was cultivating a culture of integrity in the workplace. And it was like, okay, what do I, you know, I've got a course online called Passion to Profit, how to set up your small business the right way. And it's a video course. And I took excerpts from that and just talked about things that I figured out over the years. And, you know, I won't go into it. I'd love for you guys to look at it, but I'll give you a link. You can look at it.
Sure.
Maybe it might help some of the students that you have as well. But anyway, I just put jewels of wisdom that aren't mine, but just jewels of wisdom that I've learned. And come to find out, just because of that subject matter, there was, and the rewatches or the re-listens to that webinar are typically 2 to 3 times what the subscriptions are, the people that are watching it live. And we had almost 10,000 people watching it live.
Wow.
Wow.
It's crazy.
When I'm doing it, I've got a PowerPoint slideshow that I'm going, and the tiles are literally feeding my copy and letting me know where I'm at. And I timed it out to be about 40 minutes with some Q&A at the end of it, 45. I was pretty close to on time. But on the right-hand panel, if you've ever done a Teams meeting, it shows you a counter. And I could see the counter going up and up and up. And it was amazing. I'm looking at it. And, you know, we all know what retention means. That's on the socials. Retention is the drop off rate, is when people are getting bored and moving away. Retention was up there. It stayed until the end of it. So that wasn't about me. That wasn't about everybody wants to listen to Kevin talk. It was about how important it is to somehow find a way to have a culture of integrity, no matter where we are, whether we're in a trade school or in the personal workplace or when nobody's looking or at our job. It's a toxic world in so many ways. So if we can figure out a way to incentivize people doing the right thing at work, you know, things we talked about were rotating leadership roles on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You got 10 guys on the floor. Each guy's the shop foreman for a week that month. And you rotate leadership, and that leader gets a manager's parking spot, and he gets free lunch for the whole time that he's at the leadership, and blah, blah, blah. So you can incentivize that, and it's low impact for the business. But those types of things do so many powerful things. They give people a cross-reference of what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, to be in a leadership role and have to tell people no, which, you know, because we have this incredible tendency to go into silos, to go into echo chambers and find people that want to complain about the same shit that we want to complain about.
Yep.
And it's toxic, it's dangerous, it's not helpful. So if we can immerse from those things and get out of our own heads sometimes and wear somebody else's shoes, be in somebody else's position, all it's going to do is bring us into a little bit more empathy, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's what it's about. Anyway,
yeah. Well, yeah, it is for sure.
Well, as we wrap up here, I just want to say once again, thank you so much for your leadership in industry, your integrity, and your openness to work with us and share what we're doing and be a little bit of a, I mean, I see you as a bit of a mentor mm-hmm. for what we're doing. But Kevin, I just want to say thank you so much. Your time means a lot to us, and Hopefully, I know that our listeners will get a ton out of this episode, especially at the beginning of the year if they're learning, if they're figuring out their goals for the year or
you want to start making your own goals and you don't know where to start. Step by step.
And we'll put all the links that you mentioned of all your social media and the site and stuff in the description of this episode as well.
Well, thank you guys very much. And it's great to catch up with you again. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks everybody for listening. All the links will be in the description. Please subscribe and follow Kevin, what he's got going on. Thanks, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And we'll catch everyone in the next one.